Welcome in this new sunny week with a new lecture on virtual machines. So last time we finished our exposition of the translation schemes for a functional language, and I guess as the very last thing I tried to show you that the code looks much nicer and cleaner if we make this entanglement of the jumps by kind of collecting all the code, the different code sections corresponding to closures and corresponding to function bodies in a separate at the end, for example, at the end of the program. So that means after the halt here, in this particular case, we have the body of the code for the body of the function, of this function. And then the rest of the program in this particular case consists of two local definitions of variables, namely A and F, and both of them are both definitions are non-recursive, so we just concatenate the code for the evaluating or constructing closures for the right-hand sides. So in this particular case, for the first one, 17, this is very easy. And for the second one, it is also very easy. It is just constructing the global vector for the function, which is A, and then making the vector, and then making the functional value. And then the rest is, and then one immediately proceeds to the implementation of the main expression of the let, which is just a function application, and that is this one. And following the function application, so this is a straightforward code, following the function application, only we give up the two local variables and then halt. So that's it. So the control flow then is quite straightforward and we understand it. And still then the only kind of difficult thing to understand in this sort of code is that we have to keep track of the stack distance in order to access the locals, because addressing is relative to the stack pointer and not to the frame pointer. So that is the only thing which then makes the code difficult, but otherwise the logic is very clear. Okay, so then now given this base concept of implementing functional languages, we still recall that our functional language was a little bit ridiculous in that it only was able to deal with integers and as the only data type, and that is clearly too restricted to be useful. But on the other hand, the basis is there now. We know how to deal with functions and with function applications. And with local definitions. Now, therefore, let us make a quickly review. What do we have to add in order to provide support for structured data? What is the minimal amount of structured data which we would expect from a functional language? So the first thing is, which you find in any functional language, is the concept of tuples. So that this is something to a certain degree which imperative programmers envy the functional programmers, that they can easily form pairs. So they just open a bracket. So they write when they want to have the functional people, when they want to have a pair like a number and a function, then they write a number and a function. Yeah, and then they have a pair. And if you think what you have to do in Java just to construct such a thing, you would not be, would never become happy anymore in your life. Because you have to construct a class just to have the pair, and then you have to take you need an anonymous. So in up to Java 7, you then have to construct an anonymous class with an anonymous object just to get the function done, and then you have to wrap all these things up. It's a pain. Yeah. Now with the closures in Java, the second this anonymous function is easy, but the pair I think is still not there. Or do they have pairs meanwhile? It's very convenient if you want to construct something which returns not one thing but two things, then which is not so difficult in conceptually, and therefore functional languages have the concept of pairs, and not only pairs but any kind of tuple. And clearly, if you want to have, if you group by that several things into one object, then you also might want to extract the individual components out of the tuple. So, therefore, you do not only need a constructor, but you also need to provide destructors. Destructors. So there's this this SML type of thing, the SML type of destructors. There you just do the following. You have the kind of hash thing and then a number, and then this tells you you have to extract the jth component of a tuple. So this is a little bit of problematic. Why is this problematic? Has anyone any idea? Ah, that's interesting. Yes, index violations. And why is this? So it's a typing problem what you have. Because you can apply this destructor in principle to any kind of tuple if the tuple is wide enough. So it's the question. So the first question is whether the J is a runtime expression provided by a runtime expression, or just you have to write it into the code. And if you write 5, then it means that this is a function which takes any tuple of length at least 5 and longer. And that makes it a problem. And the question is then also, where does the tuple start? Does it start with 1 or does it start with 0? And typical type systems do not have something like tuples of width at most 5. Such a thing. This notion is not supported by programming languages. So therefore, I guess in SML the way out is that this destructor is not a first class citizen. So you can only use it when provided with an argument. So therefore, then the type checker can check the argument, whether it is a tuple, okay, so that's the first requirement, and then also what is the length of this tuple, and then from that can check whether the J is smaller than the length, or at least, yeah, is smaller than the length, and can give the whole expression the type of the corresponding component. So therefore, in this case, there's a little bit of hacking with the type system, but in this case you can do it. As soon as you do not allow it as a first class citizen. And this concept, therefore, we also here perhaps do it in the same way. We do not allow it as a first class citizen, but only allow this tuple when this destructor, the selector, if you like, if it is applied to some expression E. Okay. But there's a second way how you could access, how you could invert a tuple, and this is by means of a let expression, which is, if you like, kind of a pattern matching. So, in fact, this is not a... I use this let here and not pattern matching, the pattern matching for us also, at least in OCaml you can use both, but there is perhaps the philosophical difference that a match expression allows you to distinguish between several alternatives. But here, a tuple is a tuple is a tuple. So there is no several alternatives. There's only one way. And there's only... So this is a non-failing pattern, if you like. Therefore, I prefer here for the purpose of this lecture, I just provide this for such non-failing patterns or for such an example of a non-failing pattern, only this let expression. Yeah? What is the idea here? So this means that in this let expression, not one variable on the left-hand side is bound, but several ones. And the length of the tuple expression to the left must be equal to the length of the tuple to the right. So the types must coincide. And then the variables x0 to xk minus 1 are bound. Yeah, so that is kind of our convention here. Speaking aside, so this is, in fact, this is not the only thing what you can do. I guess you can, I think also even in OCaml, you can kind of provide, make this perhaps more general by kind of replacing some of the variables with some sub-patterns or some constants, enforcing that the E1 must be of this type. So it's a check, and if the check fails, then an exception is raised. Yeah? So, but here we kind of do not consider such possibly failing let expressions, and instead kind of assume that the left-hand side only contains variables, and that the type system enforces that there is no fail, that this will always succeed. Okay, so that's kind of concerning the syntax, if you like, and a little bit of the review what we expect from the semantics of such kind of expressions. Yes. Okay, now what do we have to do for now? Let us see how we can deal with it, generate code for it. The first thing is the construction of tuples. So for the construction of tuples, so the first thing which we have to decide upon is what is the internal data structure which we have to provide. Or the, if you like, that this is a tuple is a value, so it lives in the heap. So the question is, what kind of heap object do we provide for tuples? And now my conservative assumption is we try to reuse the heap objects we have. And the only heap object which comes to mind, which fits perfectly nicely, is a vector. And we used vectors, you recall, for these accumulating already available actual parameters and also for global vectors. And so we take such a vector, and that is a tuple. This is not in the... please recall also that last time we discussed a little bit about this updating of closure objects. Closure objects have fixed size. And now a closure could also evaluate to a vector. And the vector could have arbitrary size. And so we would have to replace something with a fixed size by something with a large size. And then at that point we might wonder whether we would like to prefer, to choose another representation of the vector, perhaps using an extra indirection, our memory management easier. Yeah? But we could also say that the vector has a 5, which has a length which we can determine statically, and so that we could also, when we create a closure for a vector, we could make it large enough so that later the update will succeed. So this we could also do. So in that sense, using type information to help the memory management. So there are several possibilities. Okay, so now back to our proposition here. So I would suggest to use just vectors. And now if you want to create such an object, we need an instruction to do so, and we have one, which is the make vector instruction. What does the make vector instruction do? It expects a sequence of references on the stack, and then takes them and produces the vector. And that's so having knowing about recalling that, we then immediately see how we will construct the V code for such a vector. So we have components E0 to EK minus 1. So we construct these components on the stack by successively we generate code which will construct representations of E0 to EK minus 1 and on the stack, and there we and then in the end, once we are done with it, we use our make vector instruction with K to construct the vector. And please recall again that here, so we observe that here for the constructing E0 to EK minus 1, we have to take into account the correct stack distance. And for the next expression to be considered, the stack distance has increased because one more vector is sitting on the stack, so therefore always an increase. The other thing is that the next thing to observe is that all these expressions are evaluated in the same address environment, okay, so that we is also what we take care of. And then the third thing which we have to consider is that the question is the whole thing is V code, but what in which kind of code environment would we want to evaluate E0 to EK minus 1? So if we are in a Haskell type language, the code V means we construct the value of the tuple. Now, the value of the tuple means it's the topmost constructor. It is not so that means immediately that we also have to construct the values for the components, because some components may never be accessed. So therefore, we would construct closures for the components. Yeah, so therefore C code for the components. Yeah, because once again, because it could happen that one of these components will never be will be accessed, and therefore we dare not provide start evaluation of it because it may never terminate, and then the whole thing would not terminate. Also, if we had just constructed a closure, everything would have gone fine. So therefore, only closures for the components. On the other hand, if we are in an OCaml-like language, in OCaml, if there's a value, it is a value, and we construct the value with all components. So that means in these cases, first go to evaluate E1, E0, then E1, and so on, and only if you really have the values, then you might make the tuple. And this is not, and now Haskell programmers would kind of loathe these OCaml programmers and say, and see, because they are a little bit snobistic, but in real life, if you construct a value, you usually want to have the value, and so you construct it. Yeah? And so that you construct a value and then never access it, this rarely happens. So in this sense, the OCaml philosophy is well motivated. But these are kind of ideologic things. So for us, we only get the message, we get the demand from the Haskell community, please construct closures, and then we use C code. And if the OCaml programmer comes, okay, then he gets his value. Yeah? So that's what we do. Okay, now, so that was one thing. Now, the construction, so in this sense, was not, it was in some sense equally easy as constructing the global vector for a closure or for a function call, yeah? Because it's just the same code, only that we construct here a tuple. And please No, it's not so well, more or less similar to that. But please remark here that in this case, if we are really going for Haskell, and then we have here closures, many closures to construct, and this would be also a situation where one would like to use the same global vector and for all these closures. Otherwise, one would have to wrap the same variables again and again and again. And in this case, reuse of global vectors would be the method of choice. Okay, so that was the long discussion about this very simple scheme. Now let us proceed to the second thing. Now we have the tuple. The E returns a tuple, evaluates to a tuple, and now we want to access the jth component. So this one is now what we concentrate on. So the first thing is, here this is code V. So we want the value of this expression. So this expression is an application, if you like, it's a function application. So we want to have the result of this application. So in order to do so, we first must evaluate the E to a tuple. So if E is a closure, we have to evaluate it. Yeah? Or if it we write away generate V code for the E. Because we need the value of E, otherwise we will not be able to select the jth component. And the value of E will not be the evaluation of E completely, but only up to the top level, so that we only see on the top level it is a tuple, and see the references to the components. So that means the V, that would return the V code for E. And then now we know that. Now we have to select take the jth component and put it onto the stack. So how can we do that? We have not yet a suitable instruction for it, but we could provide it. And that is kind of a new thing, which is this get J. I just invented it on the spot. It's a new instruction to access the J. So on top of the stack, this instruction expects a reference to a vector, and then it replaces this reference by a reference to the jth component. And and then afterwards, so this reference to the jth component might be a reference to closure. And so if we want to have the value, we have to do an eval afterwards. Otherwise, we do not have a value, but a closure. Possibly a closure. So here is therefore, let me see. Here is this get J thing. So in the vector we have so it's a V object. Here is our fabulous V object. The J is J zero. Yeah, the J then would be this one. The jth component is this one. J counts the distance, the number of elements to the left of the selected component, and that means that this one has to be put on top of the stack, and where the reference to the vector has been before, and so by that the reference to the vector is gone. And instead we have a reference to the component. That is get V. And so in a case where the type discipline enforces that this get is only applied to a tuple of sufficient length, then this check is actually here I assume that, so there's a little bit of, in some sense, I must say, let me see, so this check is not sufficient. It only checks whether the whole thing is a vector. It should also check whether the J is not index out of bounds. Yeah. And again, but what I wanted to say is, if our typing discipline and static semantics of the programming language is strong enough, this check will not be necessary. But if we have arbitrary code, then it could be arbitrarily bad. Yeah? So therefore, the instruction better should also check for the J to be in bounds. So therefore, in this sense, this check here is not complete. Okay, so now the next thing is the more refined thing is that we do not just access have this get instruction, but we want to decompose E1 in one go into all its k components by means of this let thing. So what does that mean? Conceptually, this means that we kind of simultaneously define local variables y0 to yk minus 1. So in some sense, it's like a sequence of let constructs, where one let constructs the y0 and so on. But all of them are done in one go. And so what would we have to do? Well, in order to get all these local variables, we first clearly have to evaluate the E1 to a value, namely to this vector of references. And the code for it is well known to us, is this code V for the E1. Now, the code V for E1 will not provide a sequence of references on the stack, but it will only provide us with a reference to the vector. So now we have to take the vector and put it onto the stack. Now, how can we do it? Well, there is one famous instruction which does it for us. This is this get vector instruction. Get vector takes a vector and puts it onto the stack. Where did we use it? We used it for this when we kind of unwrapped the functional value. There we had to take the actual parameters which were already there back onto the stack on top of the other arguments, and that is this get vector instruction. And this comes in handy, and we use it. Yeah, just to put the references in the vector on top of the stack. And having done this, we then can proceed with the code for the E0. With the code for the E0. And so here's a little bit of an interesting. With the code for the E0. And the code for the E0 is, since the overall code for our for the whole expression is code V, so therefore also for E0 we will have to generate code V. And because we want to have the value of this E0 thing. And now we have to take care that this E0 is translated in a new address environment, and we have to take care that the stack distance has been increased by k. Why? Because now k more local variables have been pushed onto the stack. So therefore, stack distance has increased, and the row prime differs from the row by also taking into account that now we have available the y0 to yk minus 1. And so therefore, this is the definition of this row prime. It takes the address environment row and adds the new local variables y1 to yk minus 1. And what is the relative stack distance? What is the relative address of these? All of them are locals. Yes. All of them are locals. The y0 has relative address stack distance plus 1, because it's the first one on top of the stack. And then the next one increases even one more. So overall, the formula therefore is the stack distance before the whole code plus I plus 1 to get the relative address of the yi. Okay. And now here is recall the get vector instruction. The get vector instruction takes the first thing here and puts it onto the stack first, and then the next one puts it one on top, and so on. And please note, when you unpack the vectors, you have to either store the reference to the whole vector beforehand, or you here I kind of did it in this way. I stored the content of the vector in this auxiliary variable by v, and by that I could kind of consecutively push the components of the vector on top of the stack, although by that I override the vector, the reference to the vector. Okay, so that is the get vector instruction. Actually, this k here is not needed because the k is the same as here. But it's kind of this k, I have put it into the instruction in as a check, because the whole construction here is ruined if the vector turns out to have more than k or less than k components. Why? Because here we use it, so the code generation takes care, relies on that there are really k components, and also this slide k expects that there have been put k elements on top of the stack, because otherwise the wrong number of elements would be removed here. So therefore, this is here we have to insist that the vector has length k. Okay, so now this tuple thing was maybe not surprisingly, but I find it is such a useful concept, it's so easy to translate. So that is, I find interesting. That simple things can be extremely helpful. So now let us go to the more complicated things, which is lists. Now, what is the list? So list is the dynamic data structure, and in some sense, the working horse of functional programmers. If they don't know what to do with multiple data, they do not know how many they are, they put them into lists. Therefore, it is kind of a paradigmatic data type, and even if you think of languages like Lisp, that is the only data type in some sense, and everything there is lists, more or less. But therefore we have to provide a method for it. Now, what are lists in the functional sense? So lists are constructed by two constructors. One thing is a constructor providing us with an empty list, and then a constructor, sometimes also const genannt, known as named cons. So what is that? So I guess this is these names even go back to Lisp, I guess. Cons is for the constructor cell, and it has combines an existing list with a new first element to a longer list. So this is the idea of the cons. And then if you have, so after a while, you could have something like that. Yeah, this would then be a list which has been constructed from the elements 1, 2, 3. And so typically you would write it like that and implicitly assume that the brackets are there. That would be the bracketing. So it, the constructor, so you would not like to write these brackets, but you could add them. And this, so it the associates to the right. So bracketing is to the right. And typically, the people do not want to write so many double colons. So therefore, there's always this shortcut representation where you kind of enumerate the elements and put square brackets around it. And here's, again, something weird, I would say, that in the OCaml world, you use the semicolons for separating the elements in the enumeration of the list. And in the SML world, you use commas. And I guess in the Haskell world, what do they use? Commas, I guess. I guess Haskell uses also commas. So I guess Haskell also uses a single colon here. So this is the other choice. Not double colon, but single colon. So this is, I don't know why these functional programming language designers felt the obligation to change, to switch there between, so there has not yet been, has not been established a canonical, like in the C world, they have kind of canonical ways of writing things down. They have either this, the other world is split into, into communities with different preferences. Okay, so OCaml uses these double colons and the semicolon here. So that is what we, if we write examples, we may make use of this one. But these two things are semantically, so this is all syntax. In principle, these two things are the same. Okay, so now by using this the empty list and then adding elements on top of it, we can construct arbitrarily long lists. But clearly, again, the one thing is the construction, the other thing is the destruction. So if we cannot access the components of a data structure, the data structure is not so useful. So we therefore have to kind of get a hold of the first element and the rest. How can we do it? So it's in some sense similar to this let what we had for the destructing tuples, only that here we do not know whether there's a first element and the rest. It could also be the empty list. And therefore, this deconstruction is at the same time a switch. A switch or an if-then-else, if you like. So it's by means of this having something which is a list, you never know is it empty or is it non-empty. So therefore, you by the match, you kind of can deal with these two cases. So therefore, here's so in order to kind of make this so that you see how it works, or maybe you have seen it already. So here is what the append function would be implemented, how the append function would be implemented. The append function, this is kind of the most simple function operating on lists, which can takes two lists and concatenates them. So very simple. Now what does it do? So it is kind of a, it has two arguments. So here's the first argument, here's the second argument. Somehow the L is the first argument, and there you want to put Y at the end. So therefore you first check whether the first argument L is an empty list. If it is an empty list, then the concatenation should just be the second argument, the Y. If it's a non-empty argument, a non-empty list, then you are in this case, and then you know the first element of the composition is the first element of L, of the first argument, and the rest of the result list is obtained by appending the tail of the first argument to the Y. So that is, you make a recursion over the first argument. Yeah, and by that build up the result list. Yeah. So why does this terminate? It is a recursive function, so we very well might wonder whether it will terminate or not. Why should that stupid recursive function terminate? Yes. Yes, so the recursive call is applied to a shorter first argument. And since it cannot drop below zero, everything will terminate. The length cannot drop below zero. Everything will terminate. Okay. So that's for the append function. You probably have seen it. Who has not yet seen the append function before? So. So that means, here one might wonder, so there's something, so from an optical point of view, it is convenient to have, so I like it, so you can put this vertical bar in front of each alternative. You do not need that. You can also kind of skip this first vertical bar, and this standardized minimal syntax, I have omitted it. But in principle, you can also write it there. It will not harm, and the OCaml compiler will not complain. Yeah. So that's it. Okay. So that is now the kind of syntax which we need in order to deal with lists. So here these two expressions are meant for constructing lists, and this one is the match expression to deconstruct lists. And now let's go and implement it. So the first thing again is we have a new type of data value, a new type of value, and so we may again wonder what kind of data structure we might want, how do we represent them in the heap. So there's two possibilities. Actually, probably there are many more possibilities, but two possibilities could be. The first possibility could be that we reuse those data objects which we have. So what would that mean? How would we then represent the empty list, for example? Yes? Zero size vector. So we could again take vectors for representing list objects. So that would mean here in this case we would instead use something which looks like V0. So that's nice. And for the constructor, this would be then a length 2 vector. This would be completely fine. The only kind of minor drawback is that then there's no type information in some sense. And so we cannot distinguish list objects from tuples. And that in well-typed environment, this is not harmful because the type discipline will enforce that if we have a list, then it is either an empty vector or a size 2 vector, but in an untyped environment we perhaps might be more happy if we know that something is a list. So I have no very strong opinion about it, but to show you an alternative way, we kind of create a, I have decided here to, for an implementation choice, if you like, where we introduce new objects for lists. So what would we expect here? So the first thing is, we would kind of, the new list objects are new objects, so therefore they are marked as L, which is kind of the type of the thing. And then there are two kinds of constructors, so we kind of have an extra field telling us whether it is this constructor or that constructor. And then we have, and each constructor is then equipped with, with the, or the constructor, in this sense, does not wrap any data values into the list object. Therefore, this, in the case of this cons, we provide two more components for the head and the tail. And this, in some sense, why did I do this? I did it because view lists as one example of a data type which you might declare yourself. So in OCaml and in SML and also in Haskell, you can define your own data types, and this means you give them a name, and that would be kind of give you the kind of these tags here for the type which you define, and each such type comes with a finite set of constructors which are then recorded here, not by their sequence, not as a string, but perhaps represented by some number, representing the name of the constructor. And then some of the constructors may have arguments, and it could be that several constructors might have the same number of arguments, and then this vector thing would not be the most decent implementation. Or you put in the first component, very first component of the vector, a number which represents the constructor, things like that. So you can code everything into vectors, clearly, but so here we did it in this way. Okay, so now this considering this choice of this design choice for our virtual machine and our memory management, we now have to we also have to think of that there is a new instruction in our abstract heap data structure, which kind of runtime data structure, which allows us to construct these new heap objects. Okay, so now let's think of how can we translate these two expressions, the empty, in our language, so that as a result we obtain code, which, as a result of this code generation, we produce code which constructs the heap objects and returns a reference to these heap objects on top of the stack. So for the empty list, we wonder whether we have a possibility to do the job, and we have no instruction for it, so we invent it. And for the constructed list by consisting of a head E1 and a tail E2, we definitely have to first build up the E1, a representation of the E1, then a representation of the E2, and then construct the list node. But for constructing the list node, we do not yet have an instruction, so we invent it. And before, here in that case, before applying the construction, the instruction cons, we first have the code for E1 and E2, and this is again code C. So this means even if you construct a value for the composite list, the components of the list still are closures, because it may not be necessary to access the head, it may not be necessary to access the tail, so therefore Haskell will only create closures for both of them. Yeah, and the And also then observe that they are constructed with the same address environment, the E1 and the E2, but the stack distance for E2 has increased by 1 because E1 is sitting on top of the stack at the moment. Okay, now, and in case we are in our camel, then this C is again replaced by V, so we then would kind of evaluate the head first completely and the tail first completely. Okay, now here's our fabulous nil instruction. So this will do nothing but allocate a nil object in the heap and return a reference to it on top of the stack. So that is what you have expected. I guess this is not a big surprise for you. And for the cons, it's the same thing. So we first, down here is the head, up here is the tail, and then these are put into the cons object. So head first, here is the head, here is the tail. Also this now, I guess, is no longer a big surprise for you. We just construct the object. So that was, in some sense, straightforward. Now let's, more interesting is, yes, please. From what?
Vectors.
It, as I said before, you could do it also with a two-component vector. The only thing is that now here I have the data object is more informative, as it tells us whether it is a list, and it tells us here that we have a cons. Otherwise, you could a pair and a list would not be distinct. It's always two. At least typical lists do it like that. Yeah. You could, in some sense, if you have a list of pairs, and kind of a very smart implementation could kind of unbox the pair and make make a special list object where you have three components. First are the two components of the head, and then one next pointer, so to speak. But that is dangerous because in functional languages you often have polymorphic functions, and for them a value always looks the same. And that means if you have this unboxed pair and you then use that in apply one of these polymorphic functions to it, you first have to wrap it again. So in most cases, it does not pay off to do this unboxing of data structures. Okay, so here comes the pattern matching. Here is our expression E. It's a match expression. So what do we expect here? So we have, clearly, when we want to evaluate that, the first thing which we have to do is we have to evaluate the E0. And then, now there is two things which we have to do at the same time. First, we have to make a case distinction. That is, we have to check what kind of list it is, whether it is an empty list or whether it is a non-empty list. And in case, so this is like an if-then-else. So since it is since there are two alternatives, it is an if. If you had homebrewed data type with many alternatives, say 20 or more, then it would be advisable that the case distinction is like a switch, so that you kind of see the constructor and then jump to the corresponding alternative. So that would be the method of choice there. In this sense, so match is kind of like an if or a case distinction. And now there's something more beyond a C language switch. Namely, in this case, we also introduce two local variables, namely one variable for the head and one variable for the tail. Yeah, in this case. And so perhaps speaking aside, so even with lists, you could have, so here we consider only very simple pattern matching. In general, you have a pattern matching where you could make a distinction for length 1 list, length 2 list, length 3 list. You can list all kinds of patterns there, and there could be many, many variables in it. And then all the variables in the pattern will be bound when the alternative is chosen. So here we kind of restrict it only to this very simple case. Still, we have two variables here which will be bound by the match expression. So the H and the T will become local variables which can be used in the evaluation of E2. Yeah? And that means that after the E2, when the E2 is finished, then you have to throw away the H and the T. You have kind of make a slide 2 afterwards. Okay. So that here is, I tried a list of the activities to be done. So we have to first evaluate the E0. And we have to check whether it's an L object. If it is not an L object, we are doomed, or we have to complain. And otherwise, we have to compare it with the empty list. And then, if so, we proceed with evaluation of E1. Otherwise, we have to kind of unbox the two references inside the cons object, put them onto the stack, make them into local variables, and evaluate E2. Okay. So let's look here. That is the code which I propose to do the job. So the first thing is, so we want to have the value of the expression E. Now, that means we first have need the value of the expression E0. Code C is not useful because we want to get hold of the value. We must compare, know whether it's a list or not. That we only know once we have it evaluated. So code C would not do the job. So therefore, code V for E0. This leaves us with having executed the yellow piece of code, this leaves us with a reference to some heap object. Then we have to check it for a list, whether it's a list or not. So we have no instruction for it, so we do it by means of a funny instruction which we invent on the spot, and this looks like this jump at zero thing. And this means we wrap into it the address for the else. That is, if it is not the empty list. Now comes, if it is the empty list, then we proceed with the code for the E1, and this is code V because we want to have the value of it. Okay, once we are done with it, then we do we jump across the else part. So, seems very familiar to us, and proceed with the first address behind the expression. Yeah? Behind the code for the expression. Okay, so that's for the empty list part. Now for the non-empty list part. So there we have to, this is the code there for that, starts at the address A. And then we should evaluate the E2. But the stack distance for it is SD plus 2. Why? Because H and T have been pushed on top of the stack. So therefore, SD plus 2. And also this row prime is a new address environment because now we have additionally available the H and the T. The H will have relative address stack distance plus 1 and the T will have stack distance plus 2, and both are local variables. And then following this, the code for the E2, I said we need this slide 2 to squeeze out the H and T out of the stack. That's done by this instruction slide 2, which we have now seen several times before. Okay? So everything now depends on the correct implementation of our fabulous test list instruction, which gets a code address as an argument. And here it is. It expects, so there are two cases for it. Either it finds on top of the stack is a pointer to nil or a pointer to a cons object. If it's a pointer to nil, then the test list A will check, is it a list? And it is a list, and otherwise will do nothing, because then code proceeds, evaluation proceeds. So therefore just doing nothing means consuming the argument and pushing, popping the stack. That's in case a nil object is on top of the stack. So that is kind of the sequence down here, which I would like to evaluate. So I take the reference on top of the stack. I check whether it is a list. If it is a list, if it is not a list, then we flag an error and give up. Otherwise, we check if it is a nil thing, and if so, we pop the stack. Now, if we find a cons element on top of the stack, then the first element of it is the head. This is the head, so therefore it should be pushed onto the stack first. And then the second is the tail. This should be pushed on top of the head. So that's, and then afterwards, so that is, by that we have kind of initialized or put the local variables on top of the stack for the else part to be used. And then we also put this A into the PC, meaning we jump to the S part. That's it. That is what we expect. And is there a question? So, and now we have all pieces together to implement the function. For example, to show the code for the for this function up. And I tried to do it in a disentangled matter. That means, so this function app is evaluated in an address environment row, which maps this app, the variable, the name app, to a global, and to this, it's the only global. So we might, yeah. So therefore, how does the code look like? So the first thing is, The first thing is we test the arguments, the number of arguments, and here it ends. So the last thing is to return the return instruction, also which also receives the number of arguments, which is 2. So then the first thing is in the app function we have to match the first argument whether it is a list or not, and then decide what to do. So the first argument, how do we get it? So the first argument is has relative address. So the first is we start the indexing the arguments with 0. So this is therefore its relative distance is 0. So there accordingly, push log 0 will push the first argument, which we evaluate. If it's a Haskell thing, then we evaluate it. If it's an O'Connell thing, evaluation is not needed. Then comes our familiar instruction test list, where A is the address where for the case where it is a constructed list. And now comes the nil. We want to return the second argument. So currently the stack distance is still 0. The second argument, therefore, has a relative. It has index 1. So therefore the relative address, I can kind of write it down here, perhaps, so that we remember it. So L is mapped to L0, and Y is mapped to L-1. Yeah, so the formals have negative addresses. So therefore, stack distance minus relative address is 0 minus minus 1. Therefore, we have a push log 1 to get hold of the Y. So here we push the Y on top of the stack. We evaluate it to get the value. And then we have the evaluated the then part, and then we jump directly to the first address behind the code of the match behind the code for the match expression, which is here, and that then will kind of just return the value. Yeah. Okay. So that was the nil part. Now comes the cons part, and in the cons part we have. See, notice, please notice that now at that point the stack distance has increased to 2, because on top of the stack we have the H and the T. Now we want, in this case, we have to construct this head, cons, we have to construct, what kind of term do we have to construct? We have to generate code for H, cons, and then here, the recursive call of up, tail, and y. Yeah, this piece we have to construct. So now we have to push the h. Now where do we get the h from? Well, it is the local. It is the first local, so it has relative address 1. 2 minus 1 is 1. Therefore, push log 1 puts H on top of the stack. Now we have to generate the code for the Now we have to generate code for the second argument of the cons. So in this case, since we are in Haskell, we will not evaluate the application, but only construct the closure for it. So therefore, we have to look for the globals, the variables occurring in this expression. This is up, this is T, and this is Y. So we have to push all three things on top of the stack. So that is, first we have to get the up. So this is a global. And there is, we had said it is has relative address 1. So therefore, it's just push glob 0 for the up. For the T, now we have the stack distance is now 4. And so T as the second global, as the second local, it has relative distance, relative address 2. And therefore, 4 minus 2 is 2. So this pushes the T. Now the Y is we said it is a local with relative address minus 1. 5 is the current stack distance. Minus minus 1 is 6. So therefore, push log 6 to get the Y. Now we have all things for the vector, for the global vector for the expression. Then we make the vector and we make the closure. And here, in this particular place, this is the reference where the code is for evaluating this closure. But since we kind of disentangled the code, this code I have kind of postponed for evaluating this closure. In our scheme, as we presented it, this piece of code would be placed here, and one would jump across it. So, but I kind of put it aside, yeah, to make the code more transparent. So, but here is then the code for evaluating the closure. Okay, so now we have the closure. Now we have the two arguments for the cons. Now we can do the cons. Here, maybe I write it in this way. So I construct a value, and that is the return value of the else part, of the composite part. And now we are done with it, and then we can give up. We are done with the E2, so to speak. We can give up the two locals, H and T. They are no longer needed. Well, they would be needed when we want to evaluate the closure for this beast, but we have wrapped their values into the global vector. So the two locals on the stack are gone. The two locals of the stack are gone, and that is expressed, this is mirrored by the fact that here we have this slide 2, where we give up the locals. We squeeze them out of the stack. Go away. Yeah? So that's it. That's the code for the top-level code of the append. And the only thing which now remains is this. I kind of give up all these scribblings. The only part which leaves is now this one, which is the code for evaluating the application of app to T and Y. Now, but app, T and Y all live in the global vector now. In the closure, they are these, the values for these variables are sitting in the global vector. So therefore, the outermost, the rightmost argument must be pushed first. This is the Y. This is sitting rightmost in our global vector because I put it there. So therefore, push glob 2 now pushes again the Y. Push glob 1 will push the T. Push glob 0 will push the up. And then we have to evaluate this up thing, and then we can do the apply. And before all this evaluating the arguments, I forgot to say that we have to first put the stack frame for evaluating the application. And this stack frame, this marking, has the first address behind the application, the code for the application. And there we still have, because we are in a, this is the code for a closure, we have to do this updating thing. Yeah? Because when we evaluate the closure, we do not only evaluate the code, but also rewrite this reference to the closure object, which must henceforth point to the value, or be the value and not the closure. So therefore, this update here in the end. Please, in written exams, please don't forget the update for the closure code. Okay? So that's it. That was kind of, I don't know, I hope it did not exhaust you too much, but one kind of has to see how the different schemes work together in order to get a feeling that the whole thing works. Otherwise, one has only a very local view, one looks at the expression and does not see the overall flow of control in when such a right-hand side is evaluated. Okay? Could you follow? Okay, so now that is, but now you may immediately ask, he presented us only this code V, where is the code C? And now the question is clearly we have one standard option. If you want to have code C for any expression, we can always make this, we have this standard scheme which just construct the closure and wraps it around the code V. So in that sense, we are completely done. But we might wonder whether in some cases the code could be improved. So recall, for a constant, it didn't make sense to construct a closure. The constant is cheap enough. And the same was true for a function. And so the question is, are these the new language features? Do they also offer the opportunity for savings? And the answer is yes, to a certain extent, but it's a bit dubious sometimes. So perhaps we should start with this one. So if we have this code C for an empty list, and now it's clear, empty list is also nothing else but a constant, so like 15 or 16 only, that it is of list type and not of int type. And therefore, code C better should be also the same as code V. That is just construct the empty list, and that's it. Now for a constructed list, it's a little bit more intricate. We might wonder, should we construct one closure for the whole composite thing, or should we construct two closures for the individual parts and at least return the top level list immediately? And we kind of are free to do the either way. So if we will never look at this list which we construct the closure for, then everything what we might do is in every effort which we invest in constructing more things is in vain. But we might think that in most cases, if you construct a list object, also a closure for it, it might be at least that we want to know, is it a list or not, or is it cons or is it nil, and therefore it might be meaningful to construct closures not for the top-level list object but for the components of the list only, and then use this one. So to make a little bit the whole evaluation a little bit less lazy, perhaps faster. So that could be a choice which one could do. That was for the lists. And now for tuples, it's the same thing. If you will never look at the tuple, then every effort which we do for it is in vain. But we could kind of be a little bit more ambitious and construct closures only for the components. And that is in particular helpful if this vector is composed of variables. The same thing holds true, by the way, here. If this list is, if the E1 and the E2 are just variables, then for variables, the C code is just very cheap. We do not construct closures for variables, but only push the references. And in that sense, we would get rid of all closures at all, if these expressions here are built up from variables only. Yeah? So in this sense, it is meaningful to be a little bit, to try to restrict closures to as small expressions as possible, and this here would be the idea. Okay? So that's all what I can tell you about tuples and lists. And, is there any question to these constructed data? Then I would like to show you another very extremely important thing which makes programming with OCaml practical. If you only had recursive functions then you perhaps might complain, okay, so where is the corresponding language construct for while loops, for loops? What is the ingredient of a loop? So the ingredient, the main, the importance, so loops are important because they allow you to spend arbitrary much time without consuming arbitrary amount of space. And that is in particular important if you have long-running computations. Then you cannot afford to allocate more and more space because space is more, in some sense, space is more valuable than time. Because if you let your computer run overnight, then this might be acceptable. But if you cannot kind of insert more memory at runtime. So that is typically not possible. And so therefore, it is convenient to have the possibility to organize your computation in such a way that the amount of space is kind of restricted. And how can one achieve it? So in imperative languages, they kind of, it seems to me that they fear recursion, because then the stack space is consumed. And they insist of having the loops. And this is, in some sense, their right to do. The question is there something similar in functional languages? And there is. There is something like tail recursive functions. And so who has heard about tail recursion? Ah, everybody. So you can tell me. Well, here it is. Therefore I do not ask, because it's written on the slides, and so the question would be stupid. So everything there is concentrated on these last calls. So actually these last calls need not be recursive, and still you could optimize them. So what is a last call? A last call in an expression is a call whose value is the value of the expression. So consider let us look at this expression here. Now, where is a call at all? So here is a call. And so when we arrive at this place and this call is evaluated, then this is the value of the match expression. Yeah, because why is it the value? So there's no further operation applied to it. So you might now wonder, is there any call which is not such a last call? And yes, for example, if you have several function calls which are nested into each other, then perhaps the inner function calls are not last calls, but the outermost function call might be a last call. And here perhaps the most fabulous example of a situation where a call is recursive but not a last call is in this factorial function. In the factorial function, the recursive call here was applied to the argument, to the decremented argument, but then once the factorial for the recursive call for the new argument has been computed, we do not have the result of the factorial function. We still have to multiply with x. So therefore the x is still sitting on the stack, and so after the function call we have to kind of do something, and we need relevant information from the current stack frame, from the current locals, to apply to this recursive, to the result of the recursive call, in order to get the result of the current call. Therefore, this is not a last call, while this here is a last call. And now, what is the key observation? The key observation is that if we arrive at a last call in a function body, then we know whatever we compute here will be already the result of the whole function, and the stack frame. So we do not need, it's not required to introduce a new stack frame for a last call. Instead, we could reuse the current stack frame, because the result, what we compute, is already the result of the current stack, call. Yeah. So that is, the optimization which we have in mind is that we, for a last call, we do not want to introduce a new stack frame. So we save allocating a few further organizational cells. We save allocating the new stack frame, and we save deallocating this new stack frame. And by that, if we have a function which is only where the recursion only runs through last calls, then this function will never allocate a new stack frame, and therefore will operate with, or has the chance to operate with, constant memory. And therefore, if you for example want to implement an operating system or a reactive program by means of a functional language, then this is crucial that the stack does not increase forever, because it's an infinite, non-terminating, potentially non-terminating computation which you have, and that is only possible if it requires constant memory. Yeah. Okay, so if you use that, then you have something then that in this sense tail recursion, but this implementation trick, saving the new stack frame for the tail, for the last calls, will immediately translate tail recursive functions into loops. And so this means for the programmer, if he wants to have a loop, he has to write tail recursive functions. So this is the simple advice for you whenever you write OCaml programs. Try to write, to use tail recursive functions wherever you can. Okay. So now then, given that advice, we might now wonder what we have to do for a last call. So assume we have such a last call and it looks like that. Then we do not, as I said, we do not want to allocate a new stack frame, so therefore we have no marking. The only thing what we have to do is we have to allocate the new arguments, yes. And then we have to evaluate the E prime to a function, yes, that we have to do. And then the next thing what we have to do is we have to deallocate the local variables and the consumed arguments of the surrounding call. That is, we give up all the things, we squeeze out things which correspond to the surrounding call, because we do not need this information anymore. Yeah? So that means if the surrounding function had k arguments and 5 locals, then we have to squeeze out k plus 5 elements out of the stack. And then once we have done that, now we have kind of the new call replaces the old one, and we just do the apply and continue. Okay, so that's it. In that sense, and then we apply, do the apply, and the code here looks exactly like kind of it translates this idea immediately into code. So here is, we allocate the arguments for the last call, but as a by code C. We could also do it by, if it's where OCaml, we would use code V here. Then we evaluate the function of the last call. This is this code V, code V thing. And then these are M plus 1 things. If the... so here's again, this is strange. So this is not M1, but this is M minus 1. Then these M things, the M plus 1 things, namely the M arguments plus the function, these are, this block is moved, is slided, is kind of, it's not just one thing, but these M things, M plus 1 things are slided down the stack by squeezing out the locals and the parameters. And now how many elements are these? Well, that depends on the current stack distance, because the current stack distance tells us, the current stack distance here tells us how many locals are on the are still sitting on the stack. And this k thing is the number of parameters of the surrounding function. So these have to be squeezed out by the move instruction, which I have to show you, which we have to look at next time. And then once this has been squeezed out, we proceed with the application. That's it. Yeah. And next time we look at this move RM. And for today, Thank you very much.